Welcome to Brand Appeal, where we talk about brand storytelling in the digital age. I'm your host, Shannon Peel, and today I talked with Lee Wachner of Counterintuitive Marketing Agency. We talked a lot about story and everything from the comic books of our youth to brands utilizing story to connect with their audiences and make an impact in today's digital world. If you are interested in how story is reflected in our lives, what we learn from story, how our perceptions are defined from the stories we consume, this is the episode for you. But before we get going into this episode, listener, I wanted to invite you to download a special little ebook called That's Life, A Novel Approach to Changing Your Narrative from Victim to Hero Language. Just check out the link in the description part of this podcast to get your free download of That's Life, A Novel Approach to Changing Your Narrative from Victim to Hero Language. Well, now that that's out of the way, listener, let's discover what Lee has to say about story in our lives and our businesses. Lee, thank you so much for joining me here today on Brand Appeal. And I've got one question for you.
Okay.
What is it that you want to be known for?
I want to be known for making a positive impact on the world. I know that's corny, but at the same time, I don't think that ever goes out of fashion. And I'm committed to that.
Great. Now, what kind of ways are you looking at making the world a better place?
What I can do pretty well is take a big visionary look at things. I'm really good at storytelling. And when you think about it, storytelling is about identifying theme, pursuing theme, finding meaning. And that's what helps you look ahead. Like, what is the meaning of this and where does this go, right? So great science fiction extrapolates from current events and looks at the future. And almost all of my training is related to literature, language, storytelling, writing, et cetera.
Well, you're talking my language, Lee.
Yeah?
Yes.
Well, this is the perfect conversation for the two of us then, isn't it?
I think so. You know, there's so much that we can learn from a story. Mm-hmm. Sometimes think about the kind of stories, the fictional stories that I like and I engage with and I listen to on a regular basis. I start wondering, what does that say about me? And what does it mean that this is my favorite type of character? So can we identify with the genre? Or is there something that says that, something that reflects on us if we're sci-fi people or fantasy people or rom-com people?
Well, in some cases, it just means we're bored. Right now, I'm reading Elizabeth Strout. I'm reading her novels. I read Olive Kitteridge. And right now I'm reading Olive again. They're beautiful books. I mean, they're so incredibly entertaining and filled with meaning and touching and funny. And they're funny about kind of the awfulness of interpersonal relationships and misunderstanding what your family means or thinks and not having good self-perception. And it's the kind of writing that makes me feel more deeply rooted in people. But I read a lot of nonfiction. I've read a lot of science fiction. I've read a lot of science. What I know for sure about people who read a lot is that they are inherently curious, mm-hmm. And they have wide-ranging interests. So I think it's a positive reflection on everybody who reads.
We really can learn about ourselves in mm-hmm. the process. And I think that's what people don't really realize is business people are always focused on reading nonfiction. Oh, you know, I read this book and I read that book and pat myself on the back and shine my manicure. But the thing is, we can learn a lot about ourselves, the decisions that we make and how we do things through reading fiction.
Absolutely. And that's why I balance. I'm always reading a nonfiction book and a fiction book at the same time. And I'll share a statistic I heard some years ago. The number one major of Fortune 500 CEOs is English or literature. Number two is art. Number three is history. And business is below the median because those liberal arts, which always get denounced here in the States, I don't know about in Canada, but the liberal arts always get announced as being quote unquote useless. But actually what it does is it fine tunes your mind to think about creative approaches and to read more deeply into situations and to develop empathy.
Empathy. That is such an important part of branding and selling things and getting known in the marketplace. Storytelling definitely teaches us empathy. Why do you think storytelling is so important to learning empathy?
You put yourself in the other person's shoes. So in the example of the book I said I'm reading right now, I mean, Olive Kitteridge cannot see what she's like, and we can see what she's like. We immediately, because it's told from her point of view, we empathize with her, and we kind of wish she would get along better with her son and his family, and she doesn't understand how she's behaving. You know, her husband has died, and we're happy she's found someone new. And here's the funny thing, Shannon, she doesn't exist. She's just little squiggles of black ink on paper. But I'm so invested in this as a reader that I start to believe that she exists somewhere because I have visualized her.
Isn't that the truth? I mean, how often do you get into that? And that's why these franchises work so well. Lee Child's stories and Harry Potter. And because we get invested in that character and we want to know what happens next.
Yeah. So I've been invested in, you know, the Fantastic Four since I was 8 or something. You know, I'm still invested in a whole bunch of comic books, too. So I have not given up my investiture.
No, I'm a comic book fanatic as well. Very much into anything comic book and superhero, because I grew up in the middle of nowhere. And what we had, what we had was books, comics. Because there was no TV for 3 months a year. We had no TV.
Oh.
And then when we didn't even have running water or indoor plumbing for 3 months of the year. But for the rest of the time, we lived up on we lived where there's only 2 channels, 3 if we were lucky, but for the most part, 2 channels. And my parents didn't like TV to be on all the time, so they would kick us out. And what we had was comics and books and the stories that we created for ourselves in order to entertain ourselves.
I'm the youngest of 4 children, and my 3 siblings are older than I am, much older. So, well, my sister is 7 years older than I am, and then my next brother is 11 years older than my other brother, 14. So the 2 older boys were pretty much gone when I was coming of age. And it was a pretty isolated area. And so, yeah, my friends were comic books. Now, my kids look at where I grew up and they're like, oh, wow, you got to have motorcycles and ride out in the woods and go hunting and fishing and all this other stuff. And I'm like, yes, because there was nothing else to do. That's what I did.
But you also didn't have anyone else to do it with.
That's right. That's right. That's right. So now they, you know, and the other thing I tell them is, look, this thing you're looking at now, those people in those houses weren't there in the 1960s. They weren't there.
Well, it's funny that you said that. My mom had all of the videos from when we were growing up put into VHS. Mm-hmm. My son was 3 or 4. And so we're watching the videos and there's the part where we're building the house. My parents are building the house. Mm-hmm. And I'm sitting there with a hammer and nails and playing with things that, you know, kids that age wouldn't be playing with. And my son looks up at us and goes, "Where's the neighborhood?"
That's great. That's fantastic. Like,
what do you mean, where's the neighborhood? And then my parents moved into town. At that point, I had moved into town after I moved out. And so we're visiting with them. And mom goes, oh, let's go for a walk downtown. So we go for a walk. We get to the end of the downtown. And mom goes, okay, well, let's turn around and go home. My son looks up and goes, well, I thought we were going downtown. This is downtown, kid.
In an odd way, the comic books of the day. So Marvel, when you wrote a letter to the editor, if they printed it, they would print your name and your address.
Yes.
And so there were a whole bunch of us who met each other through that. We would write each other letters. Hey, I saw you had a letter in this or that. And I had 4 letters published. I had a letter in Howard the Duck, issue 5.
Really?
Yeah. And so you start to meet people, and then I subscribed to a fanzine, and then it's like, wow, there's a comic book convention I could go to. And I pestered my dad, and he took me to New York to this comic book convention, and it just opened up the whole world for me. And these are the things that led me, in a way, on a parallel track. So my life, my entire career, my life has been about the arts and about business, about doing both of them. And a lot of it comes from growing up in that rural area and being very involved in comic books.
Are you still part of loving the Marvel universe, or is it personalized now?
Oh, I don't care about that. I mean, you know, Jack Kirby, here's the funny thing, right? Jack Kirby predicted 50 years ago that these would be our new mythos, and that we were creating Achilles and Hercules and all of these. And he moved out to LA to try to spread that word. Stan Lee had done it as well. These are the two main progenitors of the Marvel Universe. And everybody laughed at them, and nothing came of it. But Jack Kirby was absolutely right. So, no, I'm very happy that there are cups and T-shirts and great movies and TV shows, and there are still terrific comic books. It's all fine by me.
Yeah, no, it's like comic books came of age, as we did.
And, you know, and then the other thing is, they're really rather faithful to the comics, and where they've made changes, they're largely positive changes. Mm-hmm. So they're improvements, not all the time, but generally they're improvements. So I'm pretty happy with them. And it's astonishing to me looking back on 12-year-old me, would 12-year-old me have ever guessed there would be not one, not two, but three Ant-Man movies? I mean, Ant-Man got a movie. I mean, what does that say?
Ant-Man got a movie, got three of them. You're right. I mean, and they're all interwoven because, yep. And that was the thing about comic books too. We'd get one issue and the story would never be completed. Because mm-hmm. we wouldn't get the next issue or the next issue. Like, we'd only get an issue here and there. Or we'd go down to our cousins and read whatever they had. But you still would read that over and over again, even though you knew that it never did end.
So. There was an issue of the Hulk where he was trapped all the way around by this impenetrable, like, jelly-like globe. And he couldn't get out of it. And the leader, who was a guy with a great big green head, the gamma rays made the Hulk strong and made the leader brilliant. And so the leader had encased him in this and the Hulk could not get out. And I read this when I was, I don't know, 8 or 10, and I could not find the next issue. And it drove me crazy for years. And I had all different ideas of how the Hulk would get out of that. And then finally, in my 40s, I think I found the next issue and I read it. And basically, he just pounded his way down through the ground. And I'm like, I thought the leader was incredibly intelligent. This is obvious. I was a little disappointed. I waited 30 years for that.
Oh, waited 30 years to be disappointed. Sometimes our imagination is the better.
Yeah. I'll tell you a little story. So I told you that this was my entree into business. Mm-hmm. My family have generally been entrepreneurs. My grandfather had a large construction firm that he did with my dad. My brother-in-law built houses. My brother had a chain of foreign car parts distributorships on the East Coast of the US. So I wanted, when I was a boy and I was like 11, I wanted to own a copy of Fantastic Four number one. And it was $60. So I said, I'm going to work all summer and get $60 and buy this. And at the time, the cover price of comic books were 15 cents. Yeah. So my mother was horrified. My mother went to my father and said, do you know your son wants to spend $60 on a comic book? And my dad's response was, well, it's his money. I mean, he can do what he wants with it. And, you know, I think he knows what he's doing. So that didn't give her any satisfaction. So that then she went to the church pastor and said, my son wants to spend $60 on a comic book. And the pastor said, well, you know, it's his money. And, you know, he's got a good head on his shoulders. And so no one would support her in her position. So she got quiet about it. And I mowed lawns all summer, $5 here, whatever. And I saved $60. And I sent it off to a guy in Long Island named Robert Bell in Hauppauge, New York. I got an envelope back from him. He sent the money order, Shannon, sent the money order back because he didn't have one. So I was crushed. So then I saved more money and my father took me to that convention in New York and I found a dealer there who had a copy of Fantastic Four number one. He wanted $85. And it was in a bag, of course, it was all sealed up. And I said, may I see it? And he said, do you have the money? And so I got real mad at him and I pulled out my wad of cash and showing him I have the money, right? And I get it. Yeah. So he pulls it out, he shows it to me and I bought it from him for $85. So I'm super happy and my mother still biting her tongue. And then I held on to it for 2 years and then I sold it for $200. And okay. Then she really had, right? So I turned a profit on it and that vindicated my dad. And then that's how I became a comic book dealer. I was a comic book dealer for some years, and I had a business partner I picked up, a guy I met through the mail in comic books, And he was in northern New Jersey. I was in southern New Jersey back in the woods. We had two big inventories. We would do shows in three or four different states and mail order. And then finally, we sold the inventory out because I was moving and I moved to LA. But I did that for years and it was great. And it was that was my first business.
Wow. How old were you when you were doing that?
I started that when I was 12. So I put an ad in before I had the partner, my dad staked me $40 and I bought some more inventory and I put an ad in a rather well-known semi-professional fanzine and started buying more inventory and selling stuff and shipping them out. And I have three kids and all three of them, they're all adults now, young adults. They've all bought and sold things in that way. My son, who still lives with me, is a reseller through eBay and other channels. My eldest, who is in the Army, used to sell candy and stuff at school until the administration caught him. He had a big markup on it. And then my daughter crochets on demand, like whatever you want. She can crochet it. She's amazing. And then she sells it on Etsy.
Oh, cool. Cool. Yeah. You've got a very creative group of kids there that are very entrepreneurial as well.
And doing other things too. Yeah. So that was my entree to the business world. I love being in business. I love what we do here at Counterintuity. And I get to work with really smart, creative people. And we do brainstorming sessions. And we talk about how do we make a positive impact on the world through the work we do. And we generally have a pretty good time every day because we think we're doing something filled with meaning because the clients are doing things filled with meaning.
So what is the best part about what you do now then? Like when you think about like you're brainstorming, you're sitting there in the group, but what is the best thing about what you do?
So I'll give you an example. Okay. One of our clients is National Association for the Public Defense. In the US, that is the group of public defenders. Well-off people, if they're caught in trouble, can afford a defense attorney, and non-well-off people can't.
Right.
When you watch cop shows, you know, the public defenders are always kind of sinister or incompetent and overworked and shady. And the prosecutors are always white knights. And sometimes people get wrongly convicted. Mm-hmm. Sometimes people did not get the defense they should have gotten. And so we have this, I don't know, stigma is not the right word, but we don't appreciate public defense enough. And the founding of the United States rests on public defense. So when the British were involved in what we call the Boston Massacre in 1775, prior to the beginning, I think I got the year wrong, but prior to the beginning of the nation, John Adams, who became our second president and was crucially important in founding the nation, defended the British. And he got criticized by all the townspeople in Massachusetts, where he was, for defending the British. And he said, everyone is entitled to a defense, and it is a pinnacle of democracy. So we've just started working with them recently, the idea of helping them change the perception about public defense in a wider scope is obviously very appealing, because when you don't understand something, and I think that many people in the United States don't understand the role of public defenders and public defense, it makes it easy to criticize. And if anything, if you want your rights to have a strong foundation, then you want to support a public defense. And we don't talk about that here in the States. So I'm very excited to work with that as an example. And that's just one example.
Well, how much do you think Hollywood has really affected the public's perception of what public defenders are?
I think a fair amount. I mean, we occasionally get a show about the wronged person. Or a movie about the wronged person. But frequently, it's the other way around. And look, most of the writers are smart people. I'm just saying maybe they could look a little more deeply into some of these things. And it's interesting, anytime there's a main story, when you think about it, if you flip the funnel and look at it from a different perspective, there's an interesting viewpoint there as well. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things, to go back to your earlier question, that's one of the things I get so much from reading literature. Literature trains you to look at things from a variety of perspectives, right? So you look at it from this way, this way, this way, this way. And that, by the way, is one of the ways one becomes empathetic.
Yeah. Well, okay, you're taking all the way around and bookmarking that.
Callback. It's a callback.
Yeah. My last novel.
Mm-hmm.
I basically took five women, very stereotypical women with very specific characteristics and lives, then threw them into situations that I had faced in my life and started to see what was going on through different points of view and understanding choices and verbiage and what other people did, as well as what my impression of the times were. Mm. And it turned out to be a very healing project because I had to look at what I did and go from victim mentality, victim language to hero language.
Mm-hmm.
And when you do that, when you go from victim language to hero language, it changes the story. It changes the character. It changes the outcome. So I learned a lot writing that novel about story.
I have to read that. That sounds very interesting. I'll have to read that. Because you can hear I'm a reader.
Yeah, except for it's not really published at the moment. And I keep saying that it was published. I unpublished it because I was going to remarket it. And then I broke it apart and made it into a program for people to come and they read, go over chapter, and we talk about it. But now I've been asked to do it as a podcast. So that's what I'm going to be doing. I'm going to be reading it as a podcast, going over the points, and then inviting people into a program to say, hey, let's look at your story and how you tell your story, your voice, tone, the verbiage that you're using. How are you seeing your past? How are you seeing your future? And let's rewrite your story into a hero story and heal through the process.
That sounds fascinating. You know, F. Scott Fitzgerald wrote Tender is the Night three times. He wrote it and then he could see that was a big dramatic leap in the middle. Then he rewrote it and then he rewrote it again to put it back. And that's my favorite one. And it's flawed. It isn't perfect the way Great Gatsby is, but that's my favorite Fitzgerald novel. I think because of the flaw and also because of the shock of what happens midway through, which I don't want to ruin for anybody.
That is a really interesting point, though, because when you're looking at that time, that time and those writers, because you've got the Fitzgeralds, the Hemingways, Gertrude Stein, you know, that there was a whole movement or a whole group of them that they got together, they talked, they experienced life. We have that in their history about what they did and how they did that and, you know, their life in Paris and how they interact. We don't have that really anymore. Or do we? Like when you look back at Byron and his team, like they would get together and they would have literary conversations and they would, you know, we would have this literature thing. And we look back at history and go, that was that group. We look at Hemingway, we can see their group. What's our group in time now?
Currently, our group is Facebook.
What does that say about us?
Yeah. So, you know, there's no great love for Mark Zuckerberg.
Is there a hard and fast rule for brands when they construct a story?
We are wired to expect that there's a twist / moral payoff at the end. Aesop trained us into that thousands of years ago. Mm-hmm. And Aristotle. I'm a little resistant to the idea of rules. Mm-hmm. You know, either it lands with people or it doesn't. So Waiting for Godot is an incredibly moving play. It wouldn't seem to be, but it's incredibly moving. And it doesn't follow that structure at all. Whatever works for you. I mean, the funniest stand-up comic I ever saw was a guy who was not a storyteller. And that was Rodney Dangerfield. Rodney Dangerfield made me laugh so hard. I saw him when I was about 19. I thought I would pass out. And he was brilliant at what he did. A group of my friends and I went to see him in Atlantic City because he could tell the audience had peaked and then he brought it down and was just talking to people for a while and then he built it back up. But his whole routine was one-liners. There's no structure there. It's a bunch of one-liners as opposed to, let's say, Richard Pryor would tell a story and Bob Newhart would tell a long story, right? So there are different structures. You know, The universe is a beautiful place filled with opportunity. There are many different ways to work.
Well, that's a great thing about being a creative is we look at things differently and we can see different. When you talk about brand storytelling, a lot of brand storytellers, they're really looking at how did Star Wars do it? How did, you know, Harry Potter do it? And let's follow this. But you're saying that, hey, just whatever works for you.
What was the new Star Wars? There isn't one. People used to say, who are going to be the new Beatles? And then finally, I think it was in the 80s, George Martin, their producer, said there isn't going to be any new Beatles. And when I was a kid, they were always trying to find the new Dylan. And if I ran you down the list of people they nominated as the new Dylan, most of them, you would say, who? Like Steve Forbert. Steve Forbert had one semi-hit, and they're like, he's the new Dylan. Nobody remembers him anymore. There's not going to be a new Dylan, a new Beatles. There's not going to be a new Rambler. That's a car. I mean, that's what that was. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I tell clients is the reason to figure out your brand identity and pursue that and to put it out there is that others can compete with you. They can't be you. So your best bet is to fully invest your marketing with who you are and what you do. And no one else can be that. It clears the board when you think about it.
I had this conversation with someone else about how clients will come to them and say, oh, we want to be like Apple.
Yeah. Well, who doesn't?
It's like,
that's silly.
We want to look like Apple. We want to, we like their marketing. We want their marketing.
Yeah.
And yet, if Apple copied somebody, they wouldn't be Apple.
Well, first, let's hire Johnny Ive because, that was all the design work, right? And let's make sure that our CEO takes a calligraphy course in college because that was the course that Steve Jobs had changed his life. And by the way, let's start out as hippies and then let's drop the hippie branding because that's what they started with. Their first logo showed Isaac Newton under, it was a woodcut image, and showed him under a tree getting hit by an apple. Because Apple really grew out of the whole Earth movement, the whole Earth catalog and the whole Earth movement. You can't magically transform yourself into Apple unless you want to go back and somehow or other recreate all of the steps that led to Apple. It's a fool's errand. I understand why people want to do that. We get that a lot, too. We want to look like the Apple website. And we take that as shorthand for, oh, I see, you want it to look clean. You want it to look clean and uncluttered. That's essentially... You don't know how to express that directly, but that's essentially what you're asking for.
I mean, you made a really good point there because you're taking it as, tell me what you like. Mm-hmm. And then we're going to get the right words out of that. So they're going to come to you with the wrong words and you're going to be able to utilize that to figure out what they really, really want. And then identify that they want clean and minimal and more white space.
You and I have a certain skill set. And expansive vocabularies. And so we're a little better at determining the intent and meaning than some other folks. I grew up with a bunch of men with very limited vocabularies. I wrote a play limiting vocabulary of the men I was writing because I was trying to recapture that. You and I have 100,000 words, and I was writing a play about three men who had like 300 words. So right?
It's like, I think I've heard my dad say 300 words, period.
Yeah. Okay. So you know what I'm talking about. And so every word stands in for 1500 different words, and it's the context will deliver the meaning. And you and I know how to do that. We're highly skilled in this area. A lot of people aren't. They're mm-hmm. highly skilled in other areas. And so one of the reasons they come to people like you and like me is because of our specific skill set that we bring to this, which is scrying the meaning out of what they're trying to communicate.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I always like to share the story where I've gone to pitch deck competitions where mm-hmm. the guy gets up to show you how he's going to pitch to a VC. And then I describe it as they stand up and they go and they throw out every single detail that they can ever think of. And then it's my job to go through all that puke and pull up good stuff.
Yep. So. Exactly right. Yep. Yep, I've done a lot of that. I was an editor at a daily newspaper years ago, I did a lot of cutting and also headlining and caption writing. And when you've written a lot of headlines, you get really good at communicating a lot with few words in a little space.
But when you think about some of the great logos out there and taglines, just do it. God, yeah. Milk.
Yeah.
It's very few words that convey an idea, a concept. And in this world of today, which is filled with movements, and everybody wants to be part of a movement of some sort or other, you need those short words. I ask this question a lot nowadays because brands will jump on movements. Do you think that they should be jumping on movements?
No.
Why? Why not?
By the time you've jumped on the movement is over. And you know, you brought up being clever about words and short. Mm-hmm. I took my girlfriend's little boy and her niece. I said to the 11-year-old, you know, if you help me watch the 3-year-old, I'll get you whatever you want for lunch. And I knew what she was going to want. It was not my ideal choice. It was McDonald's, but that's fine. So I took her to McDonald's. I ordered a spicy, crispy chicken sandwich. That's what it's called, a spicy, crispy chicken sandwich. And I'm like, what has happened to McDonald's?
Yeah.
They have the Egg McMuffin. They have the McRib. Why is this not called the McCluck? Why is it not a spicy McCluck or something like that? Spicy, crispy chicken sandwich. That's the name of this? What's going on over there?
That is interesting. I haven't been in one for a while. I'm not sure if we even have that here, but why are they having to describe it in the title?
I think because it was named by a committee of non-creatives. Listen, we got a chicken sandwich. Oh, great. Is it going to be crispy? Yeah, this is the crispy chicken sandwich. Okay. And what else? Well, it's spicy. Oh, it's a spicy crispy chicken sandwich. And there you go. Now you have the spicy crispy chicken sandwich, which sounds awful. It sounds like, I don't know, some bureaucrat from the 1950s named it. General Dynamics named this sandwich.
When I was a teenager, we'd have to get in the car and drive for half an hour or so, but you did because you had a Big Mac attack and you wanted to go. And everyone's like, hey, did anyone got a Big Mac attack? Let's get in the car and let's go because we've all got a Big Mac attack. So what are we supposed to say? We've got a spicy, crispy, I don't even know what, chicken sandwich.
Yeah, Big Mac. Excellent example. Big Mac. That's what it's called. Big Mac.
And you know what it is?
Spicy, crispy chicken sandwich.
But you know what it is? Like it's a brand. So McDonald's is a brand, but mm-hmm. so is the Big Mac.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a sub-brand. Yeah.
It has its own, like when you think of a Big Mac, you think of the time when you were a teenager and had a Big Mac attack and drove 30 minutes. You think about, you can smell it, you can taste it, you can, mm-hmm. you know, you re-experience it. Of course, when you go to get one nowadays, it just doesn't taste the same as it did when you were a teenager. And that has more to do with getting old than... the change in food.
But. I know. I just don't think they taste as good. I just don't.
They don't.
I can tell you what it's made of. 2 all beef patties, special sauce, lettuce, cheese, pickles, onions on a sesame seed bun. Now tell me that wasn't good advertising.
That was great advertising. And it was all done to music.
Mm-hmm. That's why we know it.
When I look back, I mean, on every Friday, I try to post a commercial from, so I was looking at Coke over the years. What were the Coke mm-hmm. commercials over the years from 1950s to today? And in the 80s, commercials, like in the Coke and Pepsi, I was looking at the Coke and Pepsi Wars, commercials were music videos. Why were they music videos? Because at the time, what was the big TV channel that came out?
MTV.
And yeah. And what was the most important thing to people? What is the one thing that defines the X generation? Music.
Yeah. So it was all about going over some girl's house, turning on MTV and making out with her.
Yeah.
That was my experience of that. It was great.
Well, I was all for it. We didn't have MTV, but we had Much Music up here in Canada. And I didn't even have Much Music because we didn't have cable. But I do remember the song, Video Killed the Radio Star.
Yeah.
But there are certain stories that stick with you. Those stories that we experience. And we can remember when we first listened to them. I mean, I always think that brands need to find those experiences that their ideal audience shares and try and tell those stories.
I don't know that anyone or anything is going to have that sort of lasting impact anymore. The internet has sped up and destabilized so many things, right? Generally excited about it. Gangnam Style, which was a great video and a fun song, was all the rage, just like the Macarena, and each of them lasted about 15 minutes. And they're on, they're gone, they're over. So now everything, if you can be the Macarena, that's great, but it's not going to last long. So in a way, slow and steady, but improving will win the race.
So be the turtle, not the rabbit.
Be the turtle, not the rabbit, because the rabbit gets caught in an electrified fence these days.
You know, as you were kind of going through there, I was kind of thinking, yeah, I mean, it's like something happens. We rush to the internet to watch it on the news, see the pictures, get the, what are people talking about? But it's almost like we're looking, okay, now what's next? What's going to happen now? What's going to happen next? We're always looking for the next big disaster. And when a disaster happens, it's like Ian just happened. And it's like, well, okay, it happened. Now what?
Well, yeah. And yeah, we've become too inured to the headlines. Mm-hmm. When I was a newspaper editor, I remember replating page one because there had been an accident and some Navy SEALs, some of these guys had died in a sub. And so I took a puff piece off page one that was annoying me anyway. I'd left the paper and I was at the bar across the street having drinks, and they called the bar. These are the old days. Called the bar, is Walkner here? I'll send him back. So I went back over to the newspaper across the street and they said, this sub accident happened. These guys died. And so I took this puff piece that was annoying me off of page one and I put that there on page one. Now, I don't think any of that matters because, first of all, the newspapers are primarily digital. And it's easy to update. And so we do update it constantly. We're in an evernet of outrage and incident. And so none of it makes an impact anymore. Not much.
Is there anything a brand can do to make an impact?
Yeah, sure. Let me be clearer. I'm arguing against the idea that you're going to hit the bullseye right in the center and you're going to own that, whatever that is. What I'm saying is you can be heartfelt every day. You can get your brand message across. You can make a real human personal connection with people by being genuine and being truthful to who you are. And genuineness means here's who we really are. And then you put that out there, and the people who want to associate with the values you communicate are the people who will stay in your audience. And then you have to be fair to people, right? You have to take into consideration what's going on with them, your customers, your clients, and respond in kind. So I remember when Pharrell Williams showed up at the Grammys with this big dopey brown hat, and Arby's immediately put up a thing, "Hey, Pharrell, give us our hat back," on social. It was really funny because that's the Arby's logo. It was that big dopey cowboy hat. It was funny, right?
Yes.
But they do a good job of that sort of thing. So it doesn't have to be all Sturm und Drang. You can have fun being real.
That's great. You know, Lee, I've really enjoyed this conversation because one, it has been very in-depth, very entertaining, and has brought up a lot of memories of my childhood with story and growing up. Where can people find you?
You can find me at Counterintuity, counterintuity.com. That's the website for our marketing agency. And I'm also on LinkedIn. I'm not on LinkedIn. I check it out. I don't post on LinkedIn a lot, but you can find me there. And I'd love to hear from people. I always love to talk about writing, about the future, about technology, about making an impact, and about trying to be a good human being on planet Earth. So I'd love to hear from people.
Well, I think that you have done a very good job of reflecting what Counterintuity is in today's conversation. You are definitely living your brand.
Thank you. That's nice of you. I even have an orange shirt on. It's burnt orange. It's one of our colors. You know, it's been a real pleasure speaking with you, Shannon, speaking with somebody well-informed about writers and writing and brand messages. I mean, it's really been a lot of fun. Very enjoyable.
Well, thank you very much.
Listener, hope that you enjoyed today's episode as much as I enjoy talking with Lee about story and how it has affected our lives, our memories, and our relationship with the brands that we grew up with. If you want to get your copy of the That's Life ebook that I mentioned in this episode, just click on the link in the description, head over to marketappeal.com, download the free mini ebook, and get started on changing your narrative from victim to hero, and find out how it changes your life for the better. Until next time, peel out.